The hour of 15 minutes after adjournment of the House has arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. Members, if there's, or staff, or any of the roadies and groupies that frequent our meeting, we've got a lost and found at the end of the table there. So if you, if some of that stuff is yours, please take it. Okay, so with that, we do not have a quorum at this point, but we will proceed. And members, we are, and for folks that, wish to testify, we are limited on time for this room because the floor session went longer than some of us figured, and we weren't able to start at 10:15. So we'll have limited time in the room, so keep your testimony right to the point, if you would. Okay, so with that, when we have a quorum, I'll move House File 3594. And members, this is informational only. We're not laying anything over. We're not voting. We are going to study a concept that there are some folks that support this. And so the this is our final tax committee for the year, unless we have to call one at the direction of the speaker. So with that being said, I will move the bill when we have a quorum. Is there anyone that wishes to testify in support of the bill? Okay, we have several folks. Why don't you start working your way down? Everyone that wants to testify, if you could get down here. Anyone wish to testify with concerns on the bill? Again, we're not taking a vote on it. We're not even laying it over at this point. This is informational only. Anyone with concerns? Would the department like to? Okay. And also, there's a Republican Ways and Means pre-Ways and Means meeting, I think starting at noon. So if members need to go to that, you certainly can. So House File 3594 will be before us when we have a quorum. Who would like to start out with the presentation? Well, actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to I'm going to ask Ms. Dalton to walk through the bill, and then we'll go into testimony after the walkthrough. Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to give you a very brief background on the fair tax and then take you through a very high-level section-by-section walkthrough of the bill. Fair taxes were originally proposed in 1999.
I'm sorry. Are you? I'm afraid of talking. Yes. I am going to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to give you a brief overview and then give you a quick walkthrough of the summary. Originally, fair tax was proposed in 1999 at the federal level to replace federal existing income taxes and payroll taxes with a single consumption tax. The idea is people would keep 100% of their wages and pay taxes through a higher price on their purchases. The fair tax would be built into the purchase price, making it a tax-inclusive price on all final personal consumption. I will let the advocates or proponents of the policy actually discuss the advantages and disadvantages of the bill. However, there is one issue that always is brought up when we discuss consumption taxes, and that's because that they are generally regressive. And the fair tax proposals have always included a monthly prebate or rebate, which is a refund given to all legal residents based on average consumption patterns at the poverty level for various household sizes. As I said, the bill originated as a national, as a federal bill, and it's been reintroduced every session since 1999. There are currently Senate 155 and H.R. 25 in Congress right now that are fair tax bills. Several states have also proposed eliminating state income taxes and replacing them with the state version of the fair tax. To my knowledge, fair tax bills have been introduced in Missouri and South Carolina, and there is currently one that's been introduced in Georgia. And a variation on the fair tax plan was introduced in Louisiana as well. There may be other states that have looked at this issue, but I couldn't really find a definitive source. House File 3594, Representative Drazkowski's fair tax bill, is loosely based on the bills introduced in Missouri and South Carolina, and it shares a lot of the features that you would find in the national proposal as well. Having said that, it should be viewed as a concept or framework bill. If you actually look at the bill, even though it looks very large, there's only really 17 pages of text. It lays out the basic concept of eliminating certain estate taxes and replacing them with a fair tax. But as you notice, the bill contains a delayed effective date. To actually implement the system would require extensive input and work from both the Department of Revenue and affected businesses and a lot of people who are much smarter than I am to actually develop the detailed legislation that would be needed to actually implement this proposal. So having said that, highlights of the bill. I'll start with the what is the definition of the fair tax base. And sections 1 through 4 lay out a number of changes in existing sales tax definitions and add a number of new definitions needed to define the tax base for the fair tax. The fair tax would tax a number of final personal consumption expenditures that are currently exempt from the sales tax and would exempt a number of items that are currently subject to the sales tax. Items that would be taxed under the fair tax is...
Ms. Dolan, before we start with that, we do now have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of April 20th. Any discussion? Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. I will move House File 3594, so it's before us. And again, if some members just came in, we are not voting on this. We're not even laying this over at this point, but it's, as I think Ms. Dalton hit it best, it's good to have a, what did you say? You said something that made sense. I mean, you
That's
always
so
do.
Rare.
You always do.
Mr. Chair, this is a concept bill.
Concept bill. It's a concept bill to get the idea on the table to take a look at it. And, of course, we did pass the tax bill last year. With that being said, who would like to... Okay, were you...
No.
You're going to get into the what is tax. Thank you. Ms. Dalton, you have the floor.
Items that would be taxable. Personal consumption of all goods, including necessities that are normally... that are exempt under our current law, such as food, clothing, house rentals, personal consumption of all services, and not just kind of the... services that we think about, but things like financial services, insurance premiums, daycare, and medical services, fundraising sales by nonprofits, wages paid by households directly to people who are providing services that would otherwise be taxable. So if you employed a housekeeper as opposed to employing a cleaning service, you would have to pay sales tax on the wages you paid that house cleaner. The same would be true for wages and inputs purchased by state and local governments to provide free governmental services if they are providing services that they actually charge the user for access to that service, like access to a golf course or something like that. Then they're treated like a business and their inputs would be exempt. So I think that's pretty much it. Section 10 of the bill lays out the major exemptions from the fair tax. This would be all business inputs, although we exempt a number of business inputs under our current sales tax law. 40% of our current sales taxes are actually paid by businesses. Now all business purchases would be exempt. Investment purchases would be exempt. Spending on education would be exempt because under the fair tax, education expenses are seen as an investment rather than a consumption. Purchases by a nonprofit to fulfill their nonprofit purposes are exempt under this bill. That isn't necessarily a feature of all fair tax bills, but it is in this one. And purchases by the federal government or made with federal funds would be exempt to the extent that we are prohibited by imposing the tax by federal law. And finally, used property would also be exempt from the fair tax. So you'd only pay fair tax on the first purchase of a good, not its resale. Section 11 lays out the major credit and refunds allowed under the fair tax. They include if something is bought for business use, there's a business use conversion credit. If you buy it for personal use and then actually use it for business, you would get a credit on the tax. Same for intermediate goods and services. There'd be a credit for goods and services exported and used out of the state, similar to what we have under our current sales tax. Credit for bad debt. Many of these are things that already exist. The big one that I'll discuss briefly in a little bit is the monthly rebate for qualified families, which is in Section 14. Sections 5, 6, and 13 deal with changing the, replacing the existing sales tax rate with the new tax rate and adjusting the existing tax rate on the legacy funds to account for the extra revenue that would be generated by the fair tax. The rate that would be set for the fair tax is the Commissioner of Revenue is directed in 13 to set both of these rates so that the general rate would be revenue neutral while replacing all the other taxes, and the new legacy rate would be revenue neutral compared to what it's currently raising under the sales tax. Section 7 of the bill lists the taxes that would be repealed and replaced with the fair tax. This would be the personal income tax, the corporate franchise tax, the insurance tax, occupation taxes, and all sales taxes except for the fair tax and the two dedicated excise taxes, transportation taxes, the gas tax and the motor vehicle sales tax. So this would eliminate liquor taxes, cigarette taxes, solid waste taxes. Section 8 is a minor provision that just says, you know, there's a credit if you buy something, pay the tax, and then convert it to personal use. There would also be a use tax owed if you bought something exempt as a business input and then you converted it to personal use, then you would owe the use tax. Section 9 addresses the issues of remote sellers and requires any business making at least $1 million in purchases of sales into the state to collect and remit the fair tax. This is related to the Quill legislation that we have heard earlier in this committee, but clearly if the fair tax rate is sufficiently high, you could have a big issue with driving purchases to remote sellers from bricks and mortar if you don't have a way of collecting the tax from the remote sellers. So that's what Section 9 is attempting to address. Section 12 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to draft the legislation that would be actually necessary to effectuate the changes proposed in this bill. And as part of that, there would be an advisory task force set up that would include legislators, business groups, tax practitioners, and private citizens to help actually work through the actual legislation that would make this all work. And then Section 14 provides the monthly rebate to all qualified individuals and qualified families in the state. It's similar to the federal proposed rebate. The way to think about it is if you are a family living at has an income at the poverty level, we would assume 100% of all of your income is spent, and we would give you the amount of sales tax. You would give you a rebate equal to the amount of fair tax that you would pay on that income on a monthly basis. This rebate would go to everybody, regardless of their income level. Maybe the way to think about it, to kind of give it a comparable, in the income tax system under current law, we exempt the first X thousands of dollars of everybody's income from tax, and we only start taxing above a certain rate, and that's kind of, this is the sales tax equivalent of doing that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm done describing the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. We have some folks that travel from some distance, so before we get into member questions, any brief questions on what we're doing here, Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with us having discussed e-commerce and so forth, is there anything in the bill that would reflect how we would handle collection through e-commerce?
Mr. Chair, that's actually what is dealt with in Section 9 of the bill, and it basically says if a business is making at least $1 million in sales, whether they are located here in the state or not, they are required to collect the tax.
Okay, let's get into some testimony. I see we have five folks who would like to testify. Is there anyone else that would like to come down to testify in support of the bill or with concerns? and no, nothing from the department. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so who'd like to start? Mr. David Boone, do you want to come up? And members, David Boone is from Houston, Minnesota. And so he's a constituent of District 28B, and we're very happy that you're here today. And if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record and provide your testimony.
Yes, hello, everybody. My name is David Boone, and I'm the first district director for the Americans for Fair Tax for the state of Minnesota. And I've been studying the fair tax for, I would say, a good 10 years. I will start off this morning by maybe amplifying something that Pat said about the prebate. The prebate is a return of the tax that people pay up to the poverty line. That number is determined by the health and HHS at the federal government level every June, every July, I'm sorry. And it does have a COLA attached. So that means that number goes up according to the cost of living. It accounts for inflation. I would just warn you that I hold no degrees in economics. I did, however, stay at the Holiday Inn Express last night. Well, I may not be an economist, I have spent a lifetime fixing appliances. I spent 20 years doing that for Sears. And so anytime I see something broken, I just instinctively want to fix it. And that's the state that the income tax is in this country today. It is broken beyond repair. When that happens, it needs to go on the trash heap, and we need to go shopping. And the fair tax is the answer. Just as a point of housekeeping, the fair tax is a term that's reserved for the federal proposal. It's House Resolution Number 25, and we actually have a patent on the fair tax name. So while we are encouraging people to do something of that sort at the state level, we shouldn't refer to it as a fair tax. Maybe we should begin thinking about what you want to call it if we adapt it here in the state of Minnesota. It's a consumption tax, as Pat said, leveled at all on all goods and services at the point of sale, one time only. Nothing used is ever taxed the second time. The fair tax is not a flat tax. You heard a lot of people talking about flat taxes as candidates for POTUS this year. Fair tax isn't that. And it's not a VAT tax. There are various proposals for VAT taxes at the federal level. We don't want any part of that. And it's certainly not a tweak, another tweak of the thousands of the income tax itself. It's not reform. It's replacement. So we're talking about a paradigm shift here, ladies and gentlemen. The fair tax is superior to the income tax. I'm not just saying that. It's those people that do have degrees in economics that say that. Most of them say a consumption tax is superior to the income tax in any form. I have a long list of reasons why it's superior. I don't know that I should read that off, given that we have limited time. There are 10 of them. I'll leave that to the choice of the committee. The first point is that consumption tax rewards ambition and productivity. that's something that the income tax actually militates against. For example, if you take a second job under the fair tax, you're not going to be bumped into a higher tax bracket because there ain't no tax brackets. Second point, a consumption tax takes embedded tax components out of prices. Buying a new car, a huge part of that is taxes that have been paid for, income and payroll taxes, up and down the whole line of supply. And economists disagree about what that amounts to as a percentage, but it's roughly somewhere between 15% and 20%. One thing that Minnesota should be interested in is the fact that exports would also gain from the removal of embedded tax, so that when a shipload of grain goes out from one of our ports, it does not carry those embedded taxes. And so the shipper actually is enjoying a discount of 15% to 20% compared to the income tax situation. Consumption tax gives a more stable revenue source. A consumption tax is not as susceptible to the ups and downs of the business cycle as the income tax is. So that means for people in your situations, you don't have to worry about shortfalls and even sometimes more worrisome surpluses in the revenues. Properly executed, a consumption tax cannot be used to pick winners and losers in the competitive marketplace. That's basically what income taxes has come to mean in this country. It's not so much a method of raising revenue as it is to engineer social things and to pick winners and losers. Consumption tax is transparent, not like an income tax where people don't have any idea really how much their effective tax they're paying. The consumption tax will show up on every cash register and every transaction every day. So there's going to be a number there. So the federal tax was 23%. The state tax was 6%. People are going to see that every day. And when that goes up, people are going to be well aware, and they probably will be coming back with a few complaints. The consumption tax encourages personal freedom and control. Actually, for the first time under a consumption tax, you're going to have a choice of how much tax you pay based on what you spend. So if you spend very little, you pay very little tax. If you buy a $3 million yacht, you're going to be paying a lot of tax. Actually, this is kind of interesting, you think about it, a consumption tax will tap proceeds from illicit activities. When has that ever happened in this country? So the drug dealer that buys the new Cadillac Escalade or whatever, it's going to be paying tax, even though the income possibly came from an illicit source. He gets to pay tax, just like all the rest of us. As Pat mentioned, there are quite a few states that are talking about this. Michigan and Missouri are here in the Midwest. North Carolina, South Carolina are talking about it. Georgia's talking about it. Indiana is talking about it. Iowa is talking about it. They're not only talking about it, we already have 9 states in this country that have no income tax to start out with. So one of the things that I thought would be important, and I think probably the question that arises in everybody's mind, is what is going to be the rate? And I haven't heard a rate out of the state. But I've done some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and to replace all the taxes that we propose, to replace the revenues for those taxes, is going to require approximately $16 billion for the fiscal year. Now, the numbers I find is that the gross state product, which is the equivalent of a national gross domestic product, that number is $330 billion. That's what it was in 2015. Now, we think that we will be able to tap about 85% of that, which means that the taxable base would then be $283 billion. So if you divide the $16 billion revenue that we're trying to replace by the taxable base, and I'm glad everybody's sitting here, because this is going to be a number that's hard to fathom. It's less than 6%. We are proposing to do away with the income tax, the corporate income tax, the sales tax, and various other taxes, and do it for less than what we pay for a sales tax now. What we've generally seen from reform legislation is that it's weak and ineffective, and it's usually just a matter of tweaking around the edges of the old income tax. That's what we perceive going on with the so-called various flat tax schemes that are being bandied about Congress. In 2005, President Bush impaneled the Blue Ribbon Commission and charged it with finding a plan that would be simple, fair, and transparent, and encourage economic growth. After a month of testimonies, they published their findings. Does anybody remember what their findings were? Just another dog and pony show, unceremoniously consigned to the dustbin of history. We can and we should do better here in the state of Minnesota. One thing that I would like to bring to the committee's attention is that for every percent that you increase the rate, it would mean $2 billion in revenue to the state. I know we're on limited time. I'll just leave it go at that. If there are any questions, I'd have to entertain them.
Thank you, Mr. Boone. I think before we go to any questions, if you can stick around, I'd like to get all the testimony on the record first, and then we can go into questions. And again, we are limited on time. And I apologize. No, I don't apologize. It's unfortunate that we don't have as much time, but we were on the floor a little longer than we had figured, but we did some good work there today, too. So who would like to go next? Thank you, Mr. Can you stick around, Mr. Boone?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. If you could please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Chikanowski, and I live in Winona County, Minnesota. I am an enrolled agent, a tax practitioner, enrolled to represent taxpayers in front of the Internal Revenue Service.
Welcome to the committee. Which part of Winona County?
Pickwick.
Oh. Fire department doing okay up there?
I love them. They're doing great.
They're good. They're very good.
We're looking for some land to build them a new spot, though.
Well, the bonding bill is... Oh, no.
I can put you in contact with people.
Okay. Please present your testimony.
I've been a tax preparer, income taxes, professionally for over 11 years. And I prepared payroll and sales taxes for longer than I care to admit. I can say that I read the H.R. 25 fair tax bill at the federal level in one afternoon. I cannot say that I have read our entire Internal Revenue Code. I cannot say that I understand it all. I can't say that all practitioners understand it all, as we have discussions and varying answers in situations. This bill is very worthy of discussion and of full consideration. I'm not worried about being put out of a job. Businesses still need financial help. They still have to have financials for financing. They need to know if they're making money. Many need help budgeting, and that is one of the reasons why our current system doesn't work. People do not understand what is being asked of them. Small businesses do not understand what's being asked of them. I see it firsthand. People are afraid of making mistakes on their returns. And again, practitioners cannot agree on the outcome. The taxpayer asks me a question, I tell them the steps, A, B, C, and D. They hear A and D and get in trouble on B and C. And then we have a long period of time getting this fixed. Taxpayers are unaware of the risk of only doing minor research in tax publications. Had one recently where they did a qualified distribution from an IRA for a first-time home buyer. They took out 2.5 times the amount that they should have and ended up with a huge tax bill at year end. I have arguments with my taxpayers all the time because something, it should be simple. It shouldn't be this nitpicky and absurd to do their own taxes. Even our current sales tax has complexities that businesses do not understand. I prepare sales tax returns currently in 4 states, and I have businesses that usually operate in 3 of those states. Things are taxed differently in each state. They don't understand it. What is taxable? What are the exceptions? Candy bar is taxable, except if it has flour in it, because then it's food. And apparently, attending a training for capital equipment, it used to be it was not an upfront deduction. You had to pay the tax and apply for a refund. Apparently, attending a training, paying the use tax on the equipment, and then requesting a lawful refund, it triggered a very huge audit of that company. And I actually had an auditor once tell me that businesses need to do these things, 1, 2, and 3, to make it easier for the auditors to audit them. Businesses are not in business to be audited. They want to run businesses. They want to create jobs. Any type of reform that involves income tax will only become increasingly complicated. Just look at the last 3 years since the Affordable Care Act has been enacted. It has been a nightmare for practitioners and people, taxpayers alike. I found that I spend a lot more time researching issues that should have just been simple returns. I saw a post from a fellow enrolled agent asking about time management because she was wore out after this season. By the way, this is since Christmas. I've had 2 days off. I've worked every single day, including weekends. Time management doesn't mean anything if you keep changing the laws and the situations, and we have to do more and more research. The late tax bills cause a lot of problems. We do our continuing education every year, and it doesn't involve anything if they're passed in December or January. So we have to just restudy and do more. And then there are the state conformity bills. In 2014, we were asked to delay filing returns because of a conformity bill that was passed here in Minnesota. I had printed but not delivered a return, waited for the software patches to come through, printed the return the second time, only to find out the taxpayer died the day I printed the return the second time. I ended up having to do the return 3 times so that her beneficiaries could claim her refund. What is the cost to reprogram this software with all of these changes at the state level? We could use that money elsewhere, especially in road and bridges. What is the cost to audit individual income taxes? The base is broad. With the consumption tax, the collection points are fewer. Audits would be less expensive. Residency issues. If taxpayer resides in a state 183 days but wants to maintain a legal residence in another state, software doesn't handle this very well. I've had three of these this year, and I had to trick the software to get it to function correctly. There are too many types of income and too many taxes on income. There is an exception or two to every rule. Our current system also not only taxes income, it taxes wealth and the death tax, the gift tax, and the generation skipping tax. The underground economy is often not taxed. And then there are those who just want to fudge a little on their returns. Cash, they didn't receive a 1099. They don't have to report it, right? How much charity can they deduct without having a receipt? Company paid fuel in the in personal vehicles, but they still want to be reimbursed for mileage. And the one where my aunt, the CPA, reworked my return and I don't owe as much. Well, the original practitioner did the bookkeeping all year long, so who's right? In the Affordable Care Act, there are three different definitions of household income. People don't understand the filing statuses, dependency issues, tiebreaker rules. And I've got several divorces this year where the custodial spouse did not sign the claim for exemption and is creating all sorts of additional hard feelings between parents that shouldn't be there for the welfare of the children. And they certainly don't like it when I tell them that tax code trumps family court, because lawyers and judges love to try and tell who gets what, when, and how. The IRS comes in, they say, no, this is how it's done. I had a recent IRS notice to a grieving mother. It was made out to the estate of her son, care of her. And the first paragraph said, we don't have any record of having authority to work with you. Would you please inform your son we are contacting you directly? We were both speechless. Identity theft and fraud issues are terrible. One story a tax paper shared in a publication, it took 2 years, 3 months, and 28 days to straighten out their situation with fraudulently filed returns. My own county government did not file correct 1099s when they bought a drainage easement from me. They put it in box 7, which would have been self-employment to me. When I brought that to their attention, they corrected 44 and received an audit and discovered that they were treating their bailiffs as contractors, not employees. So not even our government understands the tax code, and it is unreasonable for government to force upon its citizens a tax code even they and the tax practitioners cannot understand and agree on. Fair tax, taxes, spendings. People will understand what is expected of them. They won't have to worry about huge tax debts at the end of the year. Tax planning becomes easy. I have this amount of cash in my hand. I go to the store. I've paid my taxes. I would rather help my business clients be successful and grow their businesses rather than to respond to notices and trying to abate penalties. Minnesota needs to be a leader in tax reform. Thank you.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
Yep. Yeah. I'm going to keep.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Doug Spencer. I'm from Wabasha. I have been a fan of the federal fair tax for a number of years, and I'm working with Drazkowski to work on the state version of this, and looking forward to it.
Welcome to committee, sir.
I'm going to keep my speech quite a bit shorter than the previous ones. You're welcome. Chief Justice John Marshall famously said, the power to tax involves the power to destroy. And in Minnesota, we have seen that firsthand with the income tax. Between 2013 and 2014, it was found that Minnesota lost nearly $1 billion in net household income to other states. And that has precipitated over the years for additional losses. As far as the sales consumption taxes, typically they're considered regressive. We've already talked about the preemptive rebate, making the fair tax bill a progressive bill that doesn't tax the cost of living and the cost of basic essentials. The typical way that sales tax is exempt taxes on essentials is exempting things like clothing. If you look online, you can search for the most expensive T-shirt. There's a T-shirt that is $91,500 that's for sale, which would be exempt from Minnesota tax under the clothing exemption. And then you've got things like food, where if someone buys a $3,000 Dansuki watermelon, that's going to be tax-free as a food item. So you get a lot of skewing of what is taxable and what's not, and that sort of thing. The fair tax eliminates income-based taxes, implements a consistent tax rate covering retail sales of new goods and services, which eliminates the market skewing by industry or classification. Eliminates consumption tax regressiveness with preemptive rebate, as we talked before. That eliminates having to decide whether a candy bar is food or if it's a taxable item, that sort of thing. So you get rid of a lot of the minutia by enabling the consumers to decide what they want to spend their money on. And essentially, the fair tax becomes a tax on discretionary spending, so people can choose what they want to spend their money on, and it becomes they don't pay the money for the basics of life, but they do pay when they buy extra things. And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. It sounds like your testimony is very popular.
Yes.
Representative Draskowski, do you have a couple more folks who would like to talk?
We do, Mr. Chair. I think, just a moment. One more. And Mr. Chair, I think they're supporting the bill. I didn't even have to pay them.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. Yet to be determined. Sir, thank you for coming to our committee. If you could please state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Okay, Harold Radke, property owner in Pine Island Township, Goodyear County. Been farming most of the life and doing a few other things off the farm to try to supplement it. But I'd like to see us, let's make Minnesota the nation's top state to do business in. Because the top states prospering across the nation seem to be Florida, Texas, Alaska, states basically do not have an income tax, period. Some have a vague kind of a, Tennessee has a little bit of a form of it, but it's not quite a non-income tax state. Let's see. Despite the high tax, I think Minnesota does fairly good in bringing in as a good place to locate business, but only because of the work ethic that we have in Minnesota. But not taxing incomes of workers as well as that of business income, Minnesota would become an economic magnet. Business would be very competitive because the huge burdens of income taxes would not be embedded into the price of the products that build or the services rendered, because business, let's say, do not really pay taxes. The product is higher priced because of the embedded taxes that come along. Minnesotans would be able to buy Minnesota manufactured good at a lower product price just because of these taxes not being embedded, and it would also make a more competitive product to export from Minnesota or even to the world for that matter. Product would also, let's see, export, okay. Yeah, this would also probably reduce outsourcing to not only just other countries, but other states by these businesses, as well around the country. I think investors then would be especially interested in investing in businesses located in Minnesota, and with the entrepreneurs and businesses located here. I think this would also trend to reduce the inversions that have been happening. We've had some pretty large sized inversions in the last couple of years, probably a somewhat of a direct result of the tax increases of a couple of years ago that have happened in Minnesota. So, again, the people that are leaving the state, and it was close to $1 billion noted a little bit ago, these folks, I think, would probably, a lot of them are living out of logging their time, so they have their 183 days out of Minnesota, but spend more than that here if we did not have an income tax problem to deal with as residency. Not only every mile they drove, if they have a car that does 28 miles a gallon, I don't know how many of you have those, but that would be 1 cent for every mile they drove would be going into our road and bridge fund. Little small things like that just manage to add up over time. Let's see. The change of the fare tax for Minnesota would also take care of the problem that we're taxing the incomes, the Social Security part of our retirements, and also the veterans' pension retirement, military retirements that are getting taxed at the present time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Radke. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify in favor of the bill or with concerns thereof?
Yes, please.
You could approach the table, give us your name for the record, and begin with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Harstead, Forrest Harstead. I don't run. Life is not really like a box of chocolates. I live in Plymouth. I'm a real estate broker and a home builder and a land developer here in the metro area for over 35 years. I'm here to outline how the fare tax is actually a godsend to the housing and mortgage industries, my two favorite industries, which, of course, form one of the largest engines of our great state's economy. So first, please allow me to address the mortgage deduction argument, which is one of the strongest and loudest arguments you'll hear against the fare tax. The argument is that the elimination of the mortgage deduction is politically or socially poisonous. This argument has been used far and wide to brush the idea of the fare tax out of the minds of those who have yet to digest the idea of the fare tax. To help with that digestion, let's first chew on one following fact. Over 70% of taxpayers don't even take tax deductions. But even the few of us who do will come out far ahead due to the following. The fare tax eliminates from all the products of our great nation the embedded expenses of income tax, of payroll tax, and of all tax compliance. These embedded expenses have been estimated by economic scholars, including Harvard professor Dale Jorgensen, to average from 22% to 25% of the price of everything produced in our nation. Dave gave us a little bit of an idea how it is statewide, but I think the point is driven home nicely. Surely home construction is at the high end of embedded tax costs due to the thousands of components and man-hours in every new home. The cost of the income tax and the cost to comply with the income tax laws for every man-hour to produce those components and build those homes has to be passed on to the end buyer. It simply must be built into the price of anything and everything sold. When the fare tax eliminates those expenses, the actual cost of constructing a new house, or for what it's worth, an automobile or what have you, is then reduced by that 22 to 25%. That's nationally. Statewide, Dave spoke of some numbers. Then, taxing it with the fare tax brings the price back to the same that it is now, same price range it is now. Just that now we can see what the taxes are. Since existing homes, used homes, are not subject to the fare tax, the natural balance of supply and demand pricing in competition with those newly built homes will result in used home prices remaining in the same price ranges as well. The fundamental idea of the fare tax is to tax consumption instead of production. The consumption of all the materials, energy, and labor that it takes to build a new home should be taxed. And when that consumption is taxed, new home sales will produce one of the largest portions of the revenue that pays for our government. That's fair. We homeowners should pay for our government. That's good for our great state today. And it's in the best interest of our children's tomorrows, even our children who will become builders and realtors and lenders and loan officers. Recognize that the fare tax will also eliminate the same embedded costs to provide loans. Like every industry, the income taxes for all involved in the provision of loans will no longer need to be built in and passed on to the end user of a loan. The bond market shows us that the difference between taxed and tax-exempt rates just happens to align with Harvard professor Dale Jorgensen's prediction. Tax-exempt bonds, which are in effect loans, of course, tend to be about 25% lower than non-tax-exempt bonds. When the expenses of income tax are eliminated from the businesses of providing mortgages, mortgage rates will then become competitive with the rates of tax-exempt loans. Loan rates that would be 6.5% today then will look more like 4.9%, or 4 becomes 3, or 3 becomes 2.25. Imagine how many more of our children will be able to afford to purchase their first new home and to do so sooner in their lives. Elimination of embedded income taxes and costs of compliance with our outmoded tax system will cause expenses to decrease. But this decrease is not even the main reason the fair tax is a godsend. The following is, since the fair tax eliminates tax withholdings, take-home pay goes up instantly. Every American will have 100% of their pay at their own disposal, including for saving for a down payment. And note that savings accounts will then be with pre-tax dollars. This, of course, applies on the state level as well. Also note that since mortgage rates will be about 25% lower, many, many more people will honestly qualify for mortgages. Many more will be able to afford home ownership, and all will qualify for larger mortgages. That can't help but be a godsend to the housing and mortgage industries, the largest of engines of our economy, both immediately and perpetually. But good heavens, the fair tax will eliminate mortgage deductions. On my 35 years in the business, I've seen that buyers just don't purchase or select a home because of their potential mortgage deduction. I didn't, did you? Compared to the overall benefit that the fair tax provides to home ownership, even the few of us who can actually exploit a mortgage deduction from today's outmoded tax system still come out ahead with a fair tax. By far, very far in the long run. With the fair tax, there are no deductions because there's no income tax. With the fair tax, there is no more IRS. I'll let that one sink in for just a minute. April 15th becomes just another beautiful day to celebrate spring. The argument that messing with the mortgage interest rate deduction is politically or socially poisonous is simply a ploy to make the fair tax less digestible so that people who listen to what others tell them to think won't bother to think about it and possibly even look at it themselves. Those who have vested interest in the present income and payroll tax system are now using this argument as one of their tactics to scare the non-thinkers away from even looking at the idea of replacing income tax with consumption tax. Right at the end. Tell you what, instead of replacing it, they'll say, we'll reform the income tax with a flat tax. Again, with the fair tax in place of our income and payroll taxes, not only do buyers of new homes win, but also all who work in and around the housing industry win. That, in turn, helps our economy win. The fair tax is a godsend to our economic health. It's a godsend to home builders. It's a godsend to mortgagers, to realtors, to lumber producers, to refrigerator and toilet manufacturers, and home buyers and home sellers, and our kids, and their kids, and their kids, and on and on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify in regards to this bill? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Lepto from Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. And it may come as a shock to you that the Minnesota AFL-CIO would oppose this legislation and believes that a progressive income tax is the way to go. And we have always supported a progressive income tax, continue to support a progressive income tax. The only other thing I want to just mention is it was just because it was mentioned that nobody remembers the Bush Blue Ribbon Task Force recommendations, because when President Bush entered the White House, one of the things that he wanted was either a consumption tax or value-added tax. His Blue Ribbon Commission or a national sales tax, value-added tax in place of the progressive income tax. Not only did the commission fail to support any of these, but it took one sacred cow, capping the mortgage interest, which was mentioned, deduction that would raise taxes in the upper middle class. Taxing consumption rather than income is a practical impossibility because of fiscal and political problems of the president's own making. A consumption tax would represent a huge windfall to the wealthiest and only the Americans who save most of their incomes. And in paraphrase, a consumption tax would require an offsetting tax hike for the middle class. I'm just saying what the Bush Commission found. That's all. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
So the FLCIO is supporting the Bush Commission recommendations?
On this issue, yes.
just for the record.
Hey, we've also supported Republicans and Democrats over the period of time for elections, and whoever supports the working people of Minnesota, we support.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking up from some quotes, some great quotes by some wise men and women before our days. Winston Churchill said that we contend that for a nation to try to tax itself into prosperity is like a man standing in a bucket and trying to lift himself up by the handle. It is evident that if we reduce the tax, if we reduce the cost of something, that consumers will spend more. Obvious with our recent price of gasoline per gallon. It is known now with our surplus 2 years ago, as we've seen now, the wealth that has poured into the state because consumers have more money in their pocket because they're saving it at the gas pumps. And that money, they're not putting it in a bucket and hiding it in their backyard. They're spending it, producing more wealth. So if you want more of something, reduce the price, lessen the tax. If you want less of something, raise the tax. That's just some wise words from some of our founders and some of our great men and women around the country. So the question that I have for the author is, I have read several times over the years that there are billions, hundreds of billions, maybe even trillions of dollars of hard-working American men and women and businesses that their monies and their resources are overseas. That if we could reduce the tax or eliminate some of the taxes and the burdens, that money would be infused in the economy, into America. Is there any numbers that kind of can support that statement?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. I think that would be a widely accepted reality under a fair tax type of approach. I don't have any particular numbers, but certainly, as you point out, as you tax people more and disincentivize work and disincentivize production and disincentivize the things that people do here and chase them away to other places, if that barrier is removed, they're going to come back. And that's what this offers to the future of our state and hopefully our country.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chair. I have said enough.
Okay. Members, we'll have questions up to about 1 o'clock here, and then this is the last committee meeting. There'll be a few closing remarks, and then we will get out of here for Ways and Means. Chair Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, when I was reading through the bill on page 13, and this is a question of the author, I guess, Representative Drazkowski. Under subdivision 6, it says education costs, and this is an area that I've been, as most of you know, quite interested in through my legislative career. But it says these are areas that are exempt, and then it says education and training costs paid to an accredited institution of higher education are exempt. And I guess what I'm asking, Representative Drazkowski, how would you define that? And there's two issues in the Education Committee that we often talk about when we're talking about higher education. One is tuition, which is often pointed to, and then the other is cost of attendance, which is the real number, and that would include several other items. And so I'm just wondering how you would define that. Are we talking tuition? Are we talking cost of attendance?
Address.
And then I have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. I don't know, Representative Carlson. This has put together a very large bill and a very large idea. As an idea coming forward. And I think as we, if we are able to go in this direction, obviously the design of the bill is to ask the Department of Revenue to help us develop this legislation. There would be ostensibly a lot of discussion and a lot of work on the bill in order to get it to where it works for Minnesota. But this is a first draft at it, so I don't have an answer for you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, you know, I guess I'll accept that at this point as an answer, but any of us that have attended an institution of higher learning know that there are a lot of costs in addition to tuition. You attend a technical college and you want to become an auto mechanic, you have to buy your tools. I could go on and on. Different examples, so I think that would need a clarification at some point what we're talking about there. The other question deals with the same paragraph, and it's elementary and secondary. It says tuition paid to an accredited elementary school or secondary school program is also exempt. And my question there is somewhat the same as for higher education. When you attend a school, public or private, you often have to purchase a variety of supplies. And it's not clear whether that is the intent here, because it specifically says just tuition. For example, if you had a son or daughter in the music program, you might be buying musical instruments. And we could, again, go on and on of different examples of expenses that parents or guardians experience. So I know we have limited time, so I'll just stop there, but I could go on. I think that there are several things in the bill that raise a whole series of questions in terms of how some of that is defined. And the reason I focused on education is that we all know that one of the things going on in Minnesota and across the nation is the high cost of attendance in our colleges and universities, student debt, and a lot of related issues. And if this were to become law, I'd hate to see additional tax burden placed on our students. But thank you.
Chair Graskowski.
Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Carlson, I think those other items that you mentioned would be covered elsewhere and would, I don't know, Ms. Dalton, did we talk about this in the details around this as we were?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, there is. And Representative Graskowski, there is actually on page 6 a definition of education and training costs. It does exclude certain things like room and board, sports activities, recreational activities, hobbies, games, arts and crafts, and cultural activities. Regarding things that you would buy for education, you know, crayons, musical instruments, things like that. There is no current discussion of excluding those. That is final consumption, and this is a broad-based final consumption tax. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you are trying to eliminate carve-outs, that would be another carve-out. Whether you want to do that or not is certainly a policy discussion that would go on, but that's not included in the basic framework of the bill.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor the point, but that section there, the what was just read, does not explicitly cover the questions that I was raising with actual course-related supplies and equipment is the point I was trying to make.
Thank you.
I'll just refer to that mechanic, again, that buys his or her tools to become an auto mechanic.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. I think the last question will come from Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I see a bill authored by Draskowski and Davids, among others, McDonald, Quam, Lunan, and others. Is this the position of the majority party? And is this how the majority party wants to see our tax bill in Minnesota become? Is this what you want to see it become?
I would say that... And I'll let Chair Draskowski respond to that, too. My name's on there because it's an idea. It's a concept. Tax committee, we talk about a lot of things. And so I think Ms. Dalton coined the phrase the best, that it's a concept bill. You know, I'm not scared to look at anything. Let's take a look at it. And one thought that I do have is, and I'll talk to some folks offline here because we're going to have to wrap it up, but this is probably more of a federal issue. I'm not quite sure mechanically how it would work if one state did it and no other states did, but we'll have that conversation online. So this is a concept bill. We're not laying it over for possible inclusion. We're not voting on it. This is certainly not the idea or the position of the House GOP. It's an idea from several members of the GOP. I don't know if there's any Mrs. and others, if there's any DFL authors or not. I'm on a lot of bills because I like to hear ideas. I like to hear what different members are thinking and different citizens of Minnesota. Chair Draskowski, and then we will wrap it up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Slocum, as with any bill that goes through here, the official ideas come out on the House floor, and that's where they come out. This is like any other bill. Certainly a lot of interest by members. As a matter of fact, I think on the federal level, there's even bipartisan support for some of those initiatives as well. So it's not necessarily a Republican or a Democrat idea. I think you probably heard the construct of it in the prebates that are part of the proposal that before I arrived. But it's a good idea. It's one that, you know, it's simple, and a lot of things were covered. It's inexpensive to collect, decreases revenue volatility. We wouldn't have to do the tax expenditures report would go away virtually. Department of Revenue would shrink, I would suspect, which would be a great thing. And incent people to work and to save rather than the current disincentives or incentives for working less and spending that the income tax code provides. It would close many of the things that people refer to as tax loopholes on both sides of the aisle. Those would all go away, and the idea of home mortgages would not be an issue because you wouldn't need the deduction because you're not paying a tax to begin with for an income tax. And I can go on, and you heard a lot of those, but I think there's a lot of merit in the idea, and I think we need to have the discussion about new ideas that move us in a positive direction in a better state. So that's why we're bringing the bill forward.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly not afraid of discussions. If you've been in an education committee, you know that. I have grave concerns, though, about this bill. I really do. I have a number of low-income seniors in my district, and this bill, I believe, would tax their rent. The seniors would go to the grocery store. I've got a lot of seniors. I've got senior buildings. I've got public housing senior buildings. And I guess they're not specifically just senior buildings anymore. But you're going to tax their groceries. You're going to tax their medications. I don't think, does any other state, I'm not sure about this, but I don't think, do other states tax seniors' medications?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Draskowski.
So Representative Slocum, again, there's a prebate, and what that does is the government sends a payment back to every family to cover all of that cost that is paid in taxes on everything related, and it's, Ms. Dalton, again, it's captured, it's the average household income according to poverty guidelines or something, that they are, that money sent back to them. It's sent back to them monthly, and that's part of the construct of the bill, and that's why I'm glad we're hearing the bill today, so that people who haven't heard this before can understand that that's all offset. The government monthly sends them a check, a prebate, to reimburse them for those basic costs of living, including all of the taxes that they paid on food and housing and clothing.
Jim Slocum?
I'm...
I'll put you down as a maybe. Okay. So with that, members, this is the last tax committee unless the speaker decides it's not the last tax committee. But I just want to go through a list of thank yous here. I'd like to thank Mr. Nash. You did a lot of work, and we really appreciate that. I'd like to thank former Chair Lynn Chesky for her service on the committee last year. I've really enjoyed working with Chair Lynn Chesky in the past, and will be continuing to work with her, only in a bit of a different capacity. Molly Richardson, DFL Research, thank you so much for all you've done. Gary K, GOP Research. And I get a little nervous when I start going down a list because I will forget somebody. And so I hope I don't, but it's happened before. Nonpartisan staff, Joel Michael, Pat Dalton, Nina Manzi, Mr. Hines and Clayman, you are the dream team. And a lot of your work is just getting going. And members, I would like to say that, well, first of all, I move that we're not laying over for possible inclusion or voting on the bill, but I move that we lay House File Number 3594 on the table. Okay.
Mr. Chair, just thank you for hearing the bill, and members, thank you for your discussion and for hearing the bill as well. Thank you. Well,
thank you. And I'd also like to thank Ms. Chikanowski, Mr. Spencer, Boone, Mr. David Boone, Mr. Radke and Hartstadt, and Mr. Lado from the AFL-CIO for your comments on the bill and your testimony. Really appreciate that. So we went through the dream team here, and part of the dream team also is House Fiscal. Ms. Templin, Ms. Schill, thank you. You got a lot of work ahead of you, as does House Research. And members, we're moving into the phase now where the Tax Committee is wrapping it up. We will start the Conference Committee as soon as I get some numbers. Hopefully that's sooner rather than later. And so as members of this committee, if you see something or have a concern or a certain project or sales tax or local option sales tax or a TIF district or whatever your bill is, please talk to me about those, and we'll hopefully be able to accommodate as best we can. Committee Legislative Assistant Ethan Hellier, thank you so much. Committee Administrator Rubis, Vice Chair Barrett, Property Tax Chair Draskowski, thank you. Your committee put in a lot of time and did a lot of work. I would like to thank the Academy. I've always wanted to say that. I couldn't help myself. A special thank you to Representative Simonson from Duluth, who did more work in this committee than anyone. And we thank you for that, Ms. Representative Simonson. And I'd be remiss, certainly, the Department of Revenue has some really great folks over there. I have to say that. And I want to thank Mr. Cummings, whether he testifies for a bill or as a resource. Commissioner Bowerly, spent a lot of time working with Commissioner Bowerly, and these are folks that we'll be spending a lot more time with if you're on the conference committee. And again, I'd like to thank for what I'm about to do the conference committee over the next month and ask for forgiveness. I don't apologize, but I do ask for forgiveness. Vice Chair Barrett, Chair Draskowski, Swedzinski, Pulowski, and Davidski. We've got them all in there. Vice Chair Barrett, thank you. Thank you for your work on the committee. So from Revenue again, Mr. Cummings, Commissioner Bowerly from the Department of Revenue, and of course representing Governor Mark Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith on all the work they've done. So it's been
up already.
It's been
thank
Representative Earhart for his contributions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. So with that, it's been a great committee. Thank you for all your work. You're the best. And
you're the best.
Members, good government all the time, and don't stop believing. We are adjourned.